Welcome to All Sides with Ann Fisher. The authors of the Constitution wanted a strong but not all-powerful executive branch. They wanted to avoid the mistakes of the English monarchy and encourage peaceful transition of power between administrations. And they wanted the voice of the people to be heard. At a campaign rally last week in Palm Beach, Democratic presidential candidate Hillary Clinton reminded her audience of the presidential obligation to follow the Constitution.
When you are sworn in as president, you take an oath. You take an oath to preserve, protect, and defend the Constitution. And listening to Donald Trump's campaign, I truly doubt that he has ever read the Constitution.
And if memory serves me, Donald Trump has probably said the same thing about Hillary Clinton. Today, we're talking about the Constitution and the presidency. Ohio State University law professor Peter Shane has written books about presidential power and teaches classes on constitutional law. He joins us now. Welcome to the show.
Glad to be back, Ann. Thank you.
Joining us by phone is Tom Donnelly, the National Constitution Center's Senior Fellow for Constitutional Studies. Welcome to the show, Tom.
Thanks so much for having me.
Tom, let's start off with the basics, the primer. What does the Constitution list as executive powers?
Sure. Again, thanks so much for having me.
Sure.
I mean, I think thinking about the presidency, the framers really had two main things in mind. One is that they're quite critical. We rebelled against King George III, and so we really didn't want an executive that was as powerful as a king. At the same time, we were just coming through a period where we were under the rule of the Articles of Confederation, which was a weak government that didn't have a proper executive. It really was run by a largely ineffectual Congress. And so they were trying to straddle this, you know, something that was less powerful than a king, but more powerful than this ineffective Congress or state governors. And so what they end up settling upon is our presidency, which, you know, in the first clause vests the executive power in the president. And then the other clauses of Article 2 list some specific powers, like the power to make treaties with advice and consent of the Senate, similarly with the appointments power, the commander-in-chief of our armed forces. But I think what's most striking when you read the article that sets out the presidency versus Congress is Congress, Article 1, Section 8, and Article 1, Section 9, there's a lot of lists of do's and don'ts, powers that Congress has and does not have, whereas Article 2 is much more open-ended.
Meaning it's more about what you have and not what you don't have?
Well, I think it ends up we have a sort of ongoing – it's why we've had such ongoing debates between justices, between scholars about whether that silence means the president actually has quite a bit of power or whether that silence means, well, no, the president ought to only have what's listed specifically in there, and therefore a lot of power is lodged in Congress and relatively less in the presidency. And so it's why Professor Shane actually wrote an essay in our Interactive Constitution Center's website that talks about the Delphic Article 2, and I think that's totally true, and it's what allows for such robust constitutional debate over the powers of the presidency.
You're listening to All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. We're talking about the powers of the presidency as set forth in the U.S. Constitution. You just heard from Tom Donnelly. He's a senior fellow for constitutional studies at the National Constitution Center. Also with us, Peter Shane, professor at Moritz College of Law at Ohio State, written several books on the Constitution and the presidency. If you have a question or comment, give us a call, 614-292-8513, or email us at allsides@wosu.org. You can also check out our Facebook page and post your question or comment there. Peter Shane, how does Congress and the Supreme Court check and balance the executive? Again, it's sort of a primer, but it helps, I think, guide our conversation today.
Sure. And I very much appreciated Mr. Donnelly's comments, because they do reflect that when it came to the presidency, the framers had a much clearer sense of what they did not want than what they did want. And so the powers of Congress do get spelled out with much greater clarity than the powers of the president. What's striking about reading Article 2, though, is you can read the text of Article 2 and get the idea that the president in some way is going to be clearly weighty in military and foreign affairs. He has the power to negotiate treaties. He has the power to – he has the powers of the commander-in-chief of the armed forces. He receives ambassadors and so forth. But there is very little in Article 2 that gives the president a kind of clear stake in domestic affairs. Almost everything that the executive branch does on the domestic side, we're talking about environmental regulation, health and safety, civil rights, the regulation of securities markets, all of that. That happens only because Congress has enacted statutes that delegate authority to the executive branch to regulate or to adjudicate cases, to somehow achieve Congress's purposes with regard to the health, safety, and welfare of the American people. So Congress, first of all, you know, has to give the executive branch a driver's license before the executive branch gets to do much driving in domestic affairs. Congress every year has to appropriate money for the executive branch to carry out its functions, and that process entails a fair degree of oversight of what the executive branch does. And then Congress, the Senate, has the power to turn down the president's nominees for those officers who have to be appointed with advice and consent. So that's also a check. And of course, Congress has an investigative power, so it can just keep turning up the pressure on the executive branch if it thinks the executive branch is either misbehaving or going beyond statutory bounds. What the courts do is a little different because the courts don't have the power to initiate their own checking function. Somebody has to go to court, and the somebody who goes to court has to have what lawyers call standing. That is, they have to show that they would actually be injured by the practice of the executive branch that they're challenging. And if they do meet this standing test, then, of course, a court in many circumstances, not all, but many circumstances, will or can review the executive branch action to determine whether the executive branch has acted in a way that is consistent with statutory authority or whether it's somehow either gone beyond statutory authority or not provided the procedures that the people are entitled to or something like that. But those cases are really not constitutional cases typically. They're really about whether the executive branch has gone beyond, again, the license that Congress has given them to regulate in a particular area.
Okay, I see. So they're not seen in terms of constitutionality, but whether or not it's breaching the legislative limits set forth by Congress. Is that the whole thing about it's kind of interesting when you talk about it. It seems like the people who wrote the Constitution thought about the president as more primarily someone to represent the country to the rest of the world. Giving it the treaties, the war powers, the foreign trade issues, that kind of thing.
Yes. I mean, I think they were less conflicted about that, although, again, the precise delineation of military power was not so clear because they did give Congress the power. First, it's Congress who determines to raise an army and a navy. It's Congress that provides regulations that govern the military forces. Congress has the power to declare war. And even if Congress has not formally declared a war, there's an ongoing dialogue between the executive branch and Congress as to when the president needs Congress's express authority before he can deploy troops on the president's own initiative. So the president clearly was going to have a military function. Not clear exactly where the boundaries were between Congress and the president on that. The president was to have foreign affairs functions, to be sure. But again, it's interesting to note that if the president negotiates a treaty, the treaty was supposed to go into effect only with the consent of the Senate. But again, you know, history has written a huge gloss on this. And in fact, the United States now engages in many forms of international agreement. The number of international agreements that are called treaties is, I don't want to say it's small, it's not. There's a large number of treaties, but there's a much, much larger number of other international agreements, some of which, again, are enacted pursuant to statute so that the president has been given authority by the House and the Senate to go ahead and negotiate something. Sometimes presidents negotiate what they call political commitments, which technically are not legally binding, but there would be a great diplomatic cost to the United States in not following through. So, for example, the Paris Climate Agreement is not actually a treaty.
Right.
It never went to the Senate.
And Tom Donnelly, Peter Shane just referred to these ongoing conversations. There's an ongoing conversation between a president and Congress throughout their administration, working out the ebb and flow of all of this. But the ongoing conversation is sometimes better than others, right?
Absolutely. And I mean, I think that what we've seen in recent years, where there's been sort of relatively higher levels of polarization and partisanship and just inaction in Congress, that over time, I think what this has tended to do is increase the discretion of the other two branches of government, including the presidency. I mean, for instance, so what you end up seeing are a variety of broadly worded statutes on any number of issues, for instance, the Clean Air Act being one of them. And whereas in previous Congresses in decades past, you might see, sort of more of a dialogue of Congress, reassessing goals, revising the statute in certain ways, and the president and the executive branch reacting and vice versa, what you've seen is a relatively static statute over the course of a couple of decades. And what that does is it allows the presidents to take actions that were broadly delegated under these older statutes, subject really only to additional checks potentially by Congress, which frequently isn't able to act because there's such gridlock there, mm-hmm. Or eventually legal actions taken in the courts. And so there's a way in which the president can act pursuant to that broad discretion in fairly aggressive ways. There'll be debates over whether or not the president has overstepped the bounds, and then ultimately those questions end up in the courts. And you see that with President Obama's Clean Power Plan in the D.C. Circuit right now. Mm-hmm. You saw that with the president's executive actions on immigration. It would be the same if there were a Republican administration right now. I don't think it's a matter of one party or the other. I think it's just sort of like the natural vacuum that's created when there's relative inactivity and gridlock in Congress.
The two of you listening to the campaign promises, what they've said during debates, what they say on the campaign trail between Trump and Hillary. I'm not asking you to compare or contrast them necessarily, but do you find yourself saying, hey, you can't do that? That's not constitutional. Or Tom Donnelly, given your knowledge, a lot of people, they don't know. They just listen. It's a campaign promise. Okay, either they'll make good on it or they don't. But do you find yourself seeing it in different light?
Well, I think we see this every 4 years in presidential campaigns. I mean, I think that certainly as the 20th century wound on and we got into the 21st century, sort of the political culture around the presidency as head of party, as sort of popular head of nation, naturally the American people channel their hopes and dreams into that singular figure. That's easier to do than a disparate Congress. Mm-hmm. And I think naturally also when you're campaigning for president, you make any number of promises, or on the other hand, you attack your opponent for not getting things done. And in either case, I do often find myself saying, oh, there's sort of like there's both an overpromising on the one hand because the president can only do so much. It's such a complicated system. It was designed that way. But on the other hand, sometimes casting great blame on someone for an inability to get something done as a public official also seems to be overstated.
Yeah, I entirely agree with that analysis. There are things on both sides that have been promised that are really cornerstones of each campaign that could not be accomplished unless Congress were to provide legislative authority. Secretary Clinton, of course, has promised a massive infrastructure program to be financed in large part by adjustments in the tax code that would require legislative authority. The wall that has been the kind of cornerstone, if a wall can be a cornerstone, of the Trump campaign, I think two things are clear. Number one, Mexico is not going to pay for it. And it is not likely to be built because Congress is not going to pay for it either. And there's not going to be enough money in the discretionary funds available to the president to provide a wall along our entire southern border. There are things. I mean, the point that that Tom is making, I think, is not widely understood about the relationship between presidents and statutes. And in fact, we think of the actions that the executive branch takes as being the president's actions very often. And indeed, presidents often are quick to kind of claim credit for that. And this process probably accelerated under Bill Clinton, who said, you know, I'm going to regulate tobacco. And George Bush said, you know, I'm going to determine our policy on embryonic stem cell research. Mm. But as a legal matter, these things are typically not presidential actions. So the action with regard to immigration, for example, is actually a program instituted by the Department of Homeland Security under the Secretary of Homeland Security. And to be sure, the White House coordinated that policymaking process, but it really is, you know, the secretary who is ultimately the legal author of that program. So that means that with regard to certain things where Congress has given the executive branch fairly broad authority, you know, they haven't just said, you know, I want you to follow this precise recipe, but mm-hmm. I just want a good meal. You figure out what to serve. You figure out how to cook it. If the executive branch is in that situation, then presidents can make or candidates can make promises of doing certain things within the broad parameters of those statutes. So, you know, again, Secretary Clinton has said she would like to go even further than the Obama administration tried to go on deferred action in immigration. And it's possible, although this is all bogged down in the courts for very complex reasons right mm-hmm. now, but it's possible that she could do that without new legislation, although that would not be her preference. She's obviously going to – she's promised that she will recommend a new comprehensive immigration reform to Congress. And if Congress enacts that, that's great. But if not, she still has some statutory authority she could use.
We're talking about the presidency and the Constitution. It is complicated. Luckily, we have two people with us who understand it. Peter Shane, you just heard from him. He's professor at Moritz College of Law at Ohio State. And also with us by phone, Tom Donnelly, senior fellow for constitutional studies at the National Constitution Center. If you have a question or comment about the presidency and the Constitution, give us a call, 614-292-8513. You're listening to All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. Welcome back to All Sides. I'm your host, Ann Fisher. Last spring, President Barack Obama complained in a White House-produced video about the process of nominating someone to the U.S. Supreme Court. In the good old days, it was simpler, he said.
It used to be that people read the Constitution, and Article 2 powers fairly straightforwardly. It says the president shall make these nominations with the advice and consent of the Senate, and the person would be confirmed in short order.
Was it that simple? The Republican-controlled U.S. Senate now is said is so far refused to hold hearings on the president's nomination of Judge Merrick Garland to replace Antonin Scalia, who died in early February. Senate leaders said they want to wait until a new president, preferably Republican, is elected. This hour, we're talking about the Constitution and the presidency. We're turning our sights to the issue of the Supreme Court. Still with us is OSU constitutional law professor Peter Shane. Thanks again for joining us, Peter.
Great to be here.
And by phone, senior fellow for constitutional studies at the National Constitution Center, Tom Donnelly. Tom, thanks again for joining us.
Thanks so much.
So the current court is shorthanded and split down the middle, but it's not unconstitutional. What is the historical precedent for the number of Supreme Court justices, Tom Donnelly?
Sure. So, I mean, for the first century of the Republic, it changed at various times. I mean, it was initially six justices. Congress has the power to set the number of justices. You know, if you fast forward up to the Civil War and Reconstruction era, the Reconstruction Congress both reduced the size of the Supreme Court to make sure that President Andrew Johnson, its opponent, couldn't appoint anyone. And then when President Grant took office, they decided to increase the number of justices to 10. And so it's gone back and forth. And this has been something even during the New Deal, where there were sort of when there was a conflict between the president and a more conservative Supreme Court. We had Franklin Roosevelt proposing adding additional justices to the court. And so there have been certainly periods in our history where there have been really high-stakes, big conflict between the president and Congress and the Supreme Court, sort of over the Supreme Court's role, the role of government, and how big the court ought to be. As of now, we're currently obviously at 8, and now we just see an ongoing public debate among scholars, but also among presidential candidates and other people running for office over the Senate's relative responsibility here and the president.
Peter Shane, you wrote an article earlier this year about the Constitution as a code of honor, in which you argued that the Senate is to judge the worthiness of nominees as individuals, not to shut down deliberations altogether. And so no more is it a code of honor than when it comes to the U.S. Supreme Court?
Well, the point that I was trying to make more generally, and again, I think this is something people have perhaps not appreciated to the degree it would be helpful to recognize, is that for the system to work, there have to be not just the kind of black and white rules that are spelled out in the Constitution or even in statutes. There are also customs, traditions, academics would call norms of cooperation between the branches that put some of the brakes on when it comes to each branch trying to extend its power to the fullest possible limit. And between the end of World War II and really the 1970s, I would say with the exception of Watergate, the conspicuous exception of Watergate, there were understandings between the parties, between the president and Congress, that enabled business to get done even when there was profound disagreement. So just to take an example, kind of the first big scandal post-Watergate was the Iran-Contra scandal under the Reagan administration. And at that point, Tip O'Neill was the Speaker of the House, the Democratic Speaker of the House. He was absolutely adamant that there be no talk of a Reagan impeachment because of Iran-Contra. Fast forward to the late 90s, Bill Clinton gets in the mess he was in with regard to Monica Lewinsky.
And perjury.
And perjury, or asserted perjury. Mm-hmm. Again, perjury about an affair with Monica Lewinsky. And the House does go ahead and impeach, and impeaches even though anyone with a sense of arithmetic knew the two-thirds of the Senate was not going to be voting to remove the president. So this is a symbol of a kind of breakdown of these norms and kind of customary expectations for how each branch is going to behave. This is what's going on with regard to the Supreme Court now. Of course, Congress, if it got the president to sign it, could actually enact a statute that would reduce the size of the Supreme Court or expand the size of the Supreme Court. That's constitutional. But Congress has never taken the position that because a vacancy occurs in an election year prior to the election of a president, that they will not even think about the possibility of confirming a nominee. There were some 19th century examples where a president, the nominating president had not been elected. The president got in office because his predecessor died, mm-hmm. or where the vacancy actually occurred after a presidential election, but before the inauguration of the next president. You can find a couple of examples like that where Congress held off. But even those are well over 100 years in the past. There's simply no modern example of the Senate saying, we're not even going to consider this. Now, I suppose those senators like Senator Cruz, who are arguing for stopping any potential Clinton nominee, uh-huh. would say, we're happy to hold a hearing and hold a vote. The vote's always going to be no. But it would be interesting to see how things play out. I mean, they could have done that with Judge Garland. I imagine that they didn't do it is because they were afraid that once the American people got a look at Judge Garland at the hearings, realized the kind of record he had, it would be politically much tougher to vote no because his record is so exemplary.
Yeah, it's about as good as they're going to get from a Democratic sitting president to a Republican-controlled Congress.
Absolutely. Yeah. I think it's fair to say, given the Oklahoma city bombing prosecution that he headed. For example, I have not talked to him. I don't know his private thoughts on this. But I can't imagine, for example, that he would be a vote against the constitutionality of the death penalty, for example. That's a major concession to a kind of more moderate position.
You're listening to All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. We're talking about generally the Constitution and presidential powers, specifically right now about the issues of Supreme Court nominations. If you have a question or comment, 614-292-8513. And Barry in Bowling Green, you're on the air. Hi, Barry.
Hi, good morning. I'm enjoying your show as usual.
Thank you.
My comment is in reference to the power that the president has, not just with his executive orders or his execution of legislative powers with a pen, mm-hmm. but it's with Supreme Court nominations. And I quote from Justice Scalia's dissension with the Obergefell versus the U.S., which guaranteed the right to gay marriage in America, and your guest was just talking about customs and traditions.
Mm-hmm.
When the president gets firmly behind the support of gay rights, as this president did, sometimes customs and traditions go flying out the window. And Justice Scalia wrote, "I write separately to call attention to this court's threat to American democracy." I think all three of the dissenting justices agreed with that comment, and they either stated it in their own words. They all were didn't felt it was a threat.
So,
and I'm wondering if why the president is being assumed to have powers that he doesn't have, and the influence that the president had in influencing this court's decision on such a debatable subject without allowing it to go to the states to vote on it individually.
Okay. Can you talk about that, Tom Donnelly?
Sure. I mean, I think a few different things to say about that. I mean, one is, you know, I think that the candidates and their supporters in this election disagree on just about everything, but I think what they all agree on is this election is really important for the future of the Supreme Court. I think that questions like the future of LGBT rights under the Equal Protection Clause are very much in play when you're deciding who's going to what sort of vision of equality you're going to have when you're going to replace Justice Scalia with either an appointee by Hillary Clinton or Donald Trump. So I think it's something that voters naturally should keep in mind. I think that if you look through the history, especially you know, through a lot of the 20th century, you'll see sort of transformational presidential victories that function to transform the court. One being, you know, Franklin Roosevelt winning a series of elections and appointing 9 new justices to the Supreme Court fundamentally transformed constitutional law and sort of increased the discretion of the federal government to enact laws that regulate the economy. Similarly, with President Reagan winning in the 1980s, you see 4 new justices on the court and a court moving, you know, more in the direction of what the Reagan administration would want. We've seen that over time, and that's, you know, how that's how constitutional politics tends to play out. Finally, you know, one final way in which an administration can influence what's happening in the lower courts and at the Supreme Court is also just through arguments made through the Justice Department and through the Solicitor General's office. And so there is a certain independence in that office, but also there's certainly a way in which they can often – the arguments made in certain cases can reflect the preferences of a given administration.
Yeah, Peter Shane?
Yeah, I think agreeing with everything that Tom said, I would also add that it is fair in response to the caller's question – to recognize that the current fight that's going on in the Supreme Court is not occurring in a vacuum. What's happened over the last really 60 years is that the court has expanded its understanding of the degree to which the Equal Protection and Due Process Clauses in particular, but also the First Amendment, the ways in which these sort of key individual rights clauses, I suppose I should now add the Second Amendment, limit what state legislatures can do, what local city councils can do, what Congress can do by way of legislation. And so as judicial decisions have extended into areas, whether it's LGBT rights or separation of church and state, or abortion, other issues about which people have very deep feelings and often polarized feelings, then it becomes a more likely venue for partisan conflict over the judiciary. And even this business that we talked about before, where Congress passes very broad statutes that presidents and their administrators are enforcing in kind of more and more ambitious ways, that also puts very big issues in front of the court. The court, when it's reviewing how the Environmental Protection Agency regulates, new coal-burning power plants, for example, they're making decisions that affect a very broad swath of the economy. What's going on with the Supreme Court is really, I think, can be seen as being part and parcel of a much greater, and I'll use the word crisis in the United States, about the judicial role. You can see this in state judicial elections. Of course, over 80% of state judges are actually elected. They're not appointed the way Supreme Court justices and federal judges are appointed. And huge amounts of money are going into elections to influence the outcome on ideological grounds.
But if you ask voters, why'd you vote for that judge, they very rarely know very much about the judges at all.
Absolutely.
Or the candidates at all.
Yes.
We are talking about the presidency and the Constitution this hour. If you have a question or comment, give us a call, 614-292-8513. You can also email us at allsides@wosu.org. You just heard from Peter Shane. He's a professor at Moritz College of Law at OSU. Also with us by phone, Tom Donnelly, senior fellow for constitutional studies at the National Constitution Center. We'll be right back. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. Welcome back to All Sides. I'm your host, Ann Fisher. Presidential candidates are full of sweeping promises for change. Less clear in the campaign rhetoric is to what extent proposed change hinges on real presidential power. Republican Donald Trump repeatedly has claimed that Hillary Clinton wants to end gun rights through her Supreme Court choices. He repeated the claim at an event in North Carolina in August.
Hillary wants to essentially abolish the Second Amendment. By the way, and if she gets to pick... If she gets to pick her judges, nothing you can do, folks.
But abolishing or even changing an amendment is much more complicated than that. That's what we've been talking about, the Constitution and the presidency and presidential power. Still with us, OSU Law Professor Peter Shane, and by phone, National Constitution Center Senior Fellow Tom Donnelly. Questions or comments about presidential powers by way of constitutional or the Constitution, give us a call, 614-292-8513, or email us at allsides@wosu.org. So, Tom Donnelly, can a president abolish a constitutional amendment, or is it more complicated than that?
It is more complicated than that. Article 5 of the Constitution sets out the way in which we go about amending it, and the president has no formal role in that process. To propose amendments, it can either go through proposals by Congress or by petition of the states, and then eventually those proposals are sent to the states for ratification. I mean, the president ends up perhaps exerting influence in one of two ways. One, a president could certainly lead a constitution reform movement, an Article 5 constitution reform movement, as sort of the head of a party, head of a movement.
Bully pulpit type thing.
A bully pulpit. We saw this, for instance, with Franklin Roosevelt and repealing prohibition. That was mm-hmm. a key part of the Democratic platform of that time. So, and the other way is to attempt to appoint justices that are going to change the shape of constitutional law. You can't abolish the amendment, but you can change how it's read and interpreted by the lower courts. But what we've seen over time is it can often be difficult for presidents to predict precisely how their nominees are going to vote over time. I mean, mm-hmm. justices can often be on the court for 40 years. And their views, sometimes their views can change, or sometimes just sort of like the sorts of issues that end up before the court change, and therefore there's some, you know, you have some control of trying to put a like-minded person on there, but they are given judicial independence, and so sometimes even that can be hard to predict.
That's a huge difference right off the bat between the Supreme Court and their powers and the presidency. Is the Supreme Court is an appointment for life, however long they want, and the presidency is limited to two terms. Right off the bat, there's something of an imbalance there. You know, Peter Shane, you said something during the break that I wanted to get at a little bit. When things get out of whack, when the balances of power get out of whack, talk about that a little bit and how the chances of getting it back in balance are difficult.
The comment I made when we were talking in break is that any game theorist would tell us that when two people who have been cooperating, they've established a kind of a way of cooperating, which we would call an equilibrium. When that equilibrium breaks down, there's no smooth glide path to reestablish the equilibrium. If you're dealing with your friends, the usual way people keep each other in check is by playing a strategy that's just called tit for tat, which mm-hmm. is you're nice to me, I'm nice to you, you're nice to me, I'm nice to you, you're bad to me, I am as bad to you as humanly possible, you realize you made a mistake, you're good to me again, I'm good to you again, we go back and forth. Instead, what's happened between Congress and the executive branch over the last 30 to 40 years has been you're good to me, I'm good to you, you're good to me, I'm good to you, you're bad to me, I'm worse to you, I'm even worse to you, I'm even worse to you, I'm even worse to you. And as that accelerates, it becomes very hard. And now it just becomes a blame game. When did this start? Did this start with Watergate? Did this start with Bork? Did this start with Iran-Contra? Did this start with, Bill Clinton's impeachment? And the discussion and the leaders in Congress have very little power compared to earlier generations to discipline members of their own caucus to steer in a more cooperative direction toward the other side. This has a lot to do with campaign finance. Everybody in Congress, to an unprecedented degree these days, is a kind of independent operator. They have their own base of fundraising. Yes, they depend on the party, but basically they have their district. They have their sources of support. That's what they want to do. They want to get reelected. I've never met Speaker Boehner, for example, but I'm thinking that as he watches Speaker Ryan, the sort of internet meme of his sitting back, smoking a cigar, enjoying a martini and watching the spectacle may not be far from the truth, because he realizes better than most people is that he, as much as he would like to have struck a deal, even with Democrats on some issues, he had very little leverage even over members of his own caucus.
You said finances, but also gerrymandering as well, the districts.
Right. Well,
guaranteed districts.
Yes. So, of course, if I am a Republican or a Democrat in an absolutely safe seat, then I really don't have any particular incentive to please anyone other than the base in my district.
Let's turn to Clint now in Columbus. Hi, Clint. You're on the air. Hey, Clint.
Hello?
Hi, you're on the air.
Hi. I wanted to ask about things, the NDAA and how the president now has the power to indefinitely detain somebody, or the how the president since 9/11 has the power to essentially assassinate anybody in the world, including United States citizens, and what your panelists think about how that is kosher with the Constitution. And I'll take my answer off the air.
All right, Clint, thanks a lot for your call. Hey, Tom Donnelly, would you like to take that?
Sure. I mean, I think that these sorts of questions of national security naturally require a balancing of sort of multiple provisions of the Constitution. And so you have, a certain level of control or assertions of power coming from the presidency through the vesting clause, the vesting of the executive power in the presidency, the commander-in-chief power in Article 2, Section 2. But I mean, when you're also talking about the life and liberty of citizens, you also end up bringing in the due process clause of the Fifth Amendment. And then finally, any sort of overriding power that Congress may have to regulate those particular processes. And so it ends up being sort of a jostling between assertions of power by the president, possible oversight by Congress, with sort of the larger value of due process of law sort of overlaid on top. And so it ends up being sort of a complicated interplay between these different provisions of the Constitution.
Once again, it's more complicated.
It is complicated.
Yeah, Peter Shane.
So I'm smiling a bit at the question because there are three credit courses devoted to trying to answer that question, and I take it we don't have that much time here. But one of the things that is so there is an ongoing debate about how much military authority resides in the president directly under Article 2, and how much the president has to rely on congressional authority. And of course, there's an entirely separate question about whether military action taken by the United States complies with international law, which is its own kind of separate system of legal norms and requirements. With regard to targeted assassinations, for example, one of the things that has been interesting to me is that the Bush and Obama administrations, each of which has engaged in the practice, have had very different approaches to explaining its legal justification. With regard to the exercise of war power, President Bush and his administration was pretty quick to assert inherent authority under Article 2, that they did not want to create any impression that they were depending on Congress for the authority for the deployment of military force. The Obama administration has been much more reluctant to claim that they are exercising authority beyond what statutes allow and what's consistent with due process. So, for example, with regard to the killings several years ago of a man named Anwar al-Awlaki, he was a U.S.-born son of, I believe, a Saudi parents who were in Louisiana at the time. He moved back and grew up in Saudi Arabia. I think he was he was killed in Yemen. But he was a U.S. citizen by birth, and the United States took the position that he had taken up arms against the United States. He had made himself an enemy belligerent in that way. The case, if this had happened under the Bush administration, I'm pretty sure the administration would have had an argument that Mr. al-Awlaki had given up his due process rights by basically taking up arms against the United States and being outside the territorial control of the United States. The Obama administration didn't say that. The Obama administration conceded that due process had to be complied with before the targeting of someone like Mr. al-Awlaki. But what's confusing about that is there's no judicial process to go through. So the decision-making process, which might or might not seem adequate to the caller or to American citizens in general, would be a decision-making process entirely within the executive branch. But I think their position is we have enough internal checks that we are doing this with enough rigor so that we're not targeting people by mistake, we're not targeting someone who has not taken up arms against the United States, and we're not targeting anyone that we could capture with the assistance of a foreign government. We're only exercising lethal force in a very limited set of circumstances with which we have determined to exist in a very procedurally stringent way.
Thanks for that call. Just going to a couple of specifics when it comes to proposed policies by the candidates. We don't have a lot of time, but I wanted to get your thoughts about it. Donald Trump has promised to ramp up libel laws and target press criticism of candidates. How would that roll with the First Amendment and the Constitution? Press rights are pretty solid. What's he talking about?
Well, just as just as
is there another three credit course devoted to that?
No, okay. Actually, this is an easier question. Okay. Just as Secretary Clinton cannot rewrite the Constitution to get rid of the Second Amendment, a President Trump could not rewrite the Constitution to get rid of the First. The Supreme Court has said that newspapers, the journalists covering public figures, cannot be held libel, L-I-A-B-E-L-B-L-E, for a libel, L-I-B-E-L, unless they're publishing untrue facts with reckless disregard for the truth. And this is intended under a case called New York Times versus Sullivan to be a highly protective standard in terms of protecting free press. With regard to, just to go back to the Second Amendment for a second, I do want to say, you know, the argument that Secretary Clinton is making is not that she would necessarily want to see the Second Amendment decision of the court overturned. Mm-hmm. And I actually think the court might well stick with that decision no matter who the Ninth Justice is. That's not the issue. The issue isn't whether people have a basic right to own handguns for self-defense in their own homes, but the degree to which the government can regulate that right just as it regulates other rights. I mean, you have a right to drive a car. That doesn't mean there can't be a driver's licensing scheme. And the question would be, you know, what is the scope of regulations that you could attach to gun ownership to protect public health and safety?
On another issue, Tom Donnelly, Hillary Clinton has said she supports a number of the proposals that would require the so-called commandeering of states to enforce the proposed Clean Power Plan. You know, that's an argument against it, that it brushes up against states' rights and forcing them to comply with it. Of course, it's in the courts right now. It's not in play at this time. But what about that, Tom Donnelly?
Sure. I mean, well, that is going to end up playing. It is one of the arguments being advanced by challengers to the Clean Power Plan right now in the courts. And so I think the way in which, a Clinton administration, say if Secretary Clinton won the presidency, can most influence that will be in the arguments that it ends up advancing in the courts. I mean, the combination of sticking to the Clean Power Plan as sort of the appropriate application of the Clean Air Act to the issue of climate change, and then furthermore pressing these arguments that the Clean Power Plan, as it's put together, and the role that it assigns to the states in aiding its implementation of the program is consistent with the Clean Air Act, but also with the Constitution.
Okay, and then another issue. Donald Trump has supported a nationwide stop and frisk policy that also bumps into the 10th Amendment states' rights. Right, Peter Shane? I mean, that's...
Yes.
I mean, but it's also been found unconstitutional in New York.
Right. And, you know, the circumstance, you know, it's how stop and frisk is done in different jurisdictions might well affect whether judges viewing the stop and frisk practice in different jurisdictions would view its constitutionality. The way it was being implemented in New York was found to be racially discriminatory. I mean, that's not, I suppose, it's not inevitable that mm-hmm. stop and frisk would always be done in a racially discriminatory way. But the main point is that, you know, the local and state and local police forces are not run by the government of the United States. The policies you know, our state and local police are set at a local level. FBI agents don't, you know, walk the streets conducting stop and frisk.
Mm-hmm. Well, there's lots more to talk about, of course. That's all the time we have this hour. Peter Shane, thanks for joining us.
I can't believe it's already been an hour.
Peter Shane, professor at Moritz College of Law at Ohio State University. And also Tom Donnelly, thanks so much for joining us.
Thanks so much. Great talking to you.
Tom Donnelly, Senior Fellow for Constitutional Studies at the National Constitution Center. Thanks to Shelby Powers for producing this show. Thanks to the All Sides staff, including producer Michael DeBonis, assistant producer Shyla Knott, All Sides interns Walter Haupt, Jessica Shakespeare, and Shelby Powers, with video production by Rich Karsmitsky and Amber Karsmitsky. Alan DeCenzo is the composer of our theme music. Thanks for listening. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News.